From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore how UWM is approaching student organizing and campus protests as a new school year begins. Then we'll speak to a children's book author about Gertie, the darling duck of World War II.
Boy Scouts were on guard. There was a humane officer on guard that had the ability to arrest. And the bridge tenders were so protected, they called Gertie's ducklings their godchildren.
Plus, we'll learn about Milwaukee music legend Al Jarreau and the park named after him.
Come to the park, look at the vibrancy of the mural, and bring your phone and put on some Al Jarreau music. and I'm sure whatever that little funk is, you are going to be okay.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Earlier this year, student encampments took over parts of both UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee campuses, calling for an end to genocide in Gaza. As a new school year kicks off, the bombings continue, but those student groups and universities have undergone some big changes. Five UW-Milwaukee student groups were suspended in July over an Instagram post that the university said used, quote, intimidating language aimed at the local Jewish community and students. The student groups argued that they were using the same language the World Court used when describing Israel's actions. In the latest development, UW-Madison updated its protest policy just last week. To better understand what's happening today, Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter at the Journal Sentinel.
This may seem odd, but I want to start us back. Earlier this year, late spring semester, tents went up on UW and UWM's campus. Students are calling on their universities to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. How did the university tactics differ here between UW and UWM?
Very much so. In the first couple days, you know, it seemed like they were on parallel tracks at Madison and Milwaukee. You know, there were these encampments, they were growing in size. But Madison gets a lot more attention and more pressure. Within hours of those tents going up, Republican lawmakers at the Capitol were calling for UW-Madison to enforce the rule that says no camping allowed on campus. And UWM was not getting as much attention, so that they weren't really facing as much pressure. And by day three, the UW-Madison chancellor sent in police to break up the encampment, and it became sort of violent. There was clashes between protesters and police, and it really changed the dynamic there. I think a lot of people on campus felt a loss of trust in the chancellor, at least in that moment. And the encampment, the tents popped right back up, like, within the hour. So it was sort of, a lot of people thought, what was the point of that? It was very unsuccessful. And it really sent them into negotiating with the protesters to try to find some way forward, because they realized that police intervention was not going to end this. UWM never sent in police. They did, you know, face a little more pressure within the second week, but they never sent in police. And by, you know, the end of week two, both campuses had reached agreements with their protesters. The key difference there, Madison's was very politically neutral, and UWM's was not, at least, you know, in the eyes of many within the Jewish community, and just outsiders thought that there was language in there sort of condemning genocide, and they thought it was very one-sided, which got them into hot water sort of after the fact.
This leads UWM to go on to issue this apology. What do they say here?
Well, before the apology, there was, like, the Chancellor Mone's boss, UW System President Jay Rothman. He sort of issued a very unusual and public rebuke of UWM, you know, saying that we want our universities to maintain viewpoint neutrality when it comes to controversial topics. So UWM sort of got called out publicly, very unusual. And then I think about a week later, UWM's chancellor apologized for taking that position.
And so last month, you reported on the pressure that UWM Chancellor Mark Mone felt during this time, not just from Jay Rothman, but from the local Jewish community and big donors to the university. What did you learn through that reporting?
Yeah, myself and another reporter, we went through over 1,000 pages of emails and text messages that we'd gotten from both UW-Madison and UWM, the chancellors there. And it was interesting to see, like, how much pressure and what they were saying, like, behind the scenes to each other. A lot of donors are Jewish, at least at UWM, and it was interesting reading a lot of their emails. The Peck family, which is the Peck School of the Arts, is named after this family. They wrote that to Moni that we believe you're passing the buck, burying your head in the sand, and not actively dealing with this serious issue. There was an email from the former Northwestern Mutual CEO, Ed Zor, who emailed Moni, if UWM gives in to any of these bullshit demands, you will get no more dollars from the Zors. These are dumb kids that can't think, and they have no business being in college.
Yeah, rough.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are a lot more honest in emails and texts that they think aren't going to become public. So it was interesting to read through the records and get this insight and the pressure that they were facing while this was going on. It was a very tense time for these chancellors.
And there, like you said, over 1,000 pages that came back to you. And sometimes it's hard to know what to expect from like an open records or a FOIA request of what you're going to get. What surprised you from the university?
I mean, with the exception of a lot of the donor sort of interactions we saw, most of the students and professors on these campuses that were emailing him or texting him were generally very supportive of UWM's approach, at least before the agreement was reached, and they were very happy that police were not sent in. And I thought that was sort of interesting because when you're reporting in the middle of it, it's hard to know, you know, if there is consensus on what is happening or if it's fairly evenly divided. I mean, you can talk to a bunch of people, but still never really get a sense of how everyone, you know, every single person on campus feels. So that was interesting.
Hmm. Eventually, after all this, Chancellor Moni announces his resignation. He's still with the university in advisory capacity now?
He's serving this school year as chancellor. So he's okay. One more school year as chancellor, but he announced he's stepping down, which sort of launches the whole process to run a search, find his successor, and who will take over at the end of, you know, next summer.
Gotcha. And how do you read all of that?
I mean, I think it's up to interpretation. I certainly asked him and the university and the UW system, you know, was he asked to step down? Was he sort of pushed out? I think a lot of people read it as that. You know, he announced he was stepping down a little over a month after this whole controversy where his boss sort of publicly rebuked him. They did not want to engage in my questions. I do think the day that this resignation was announced is interesting. It was announced on July 3rd, you know, right before a long holiday weekend. Typically, chancellors who have given over a decade, you know, of service in leadership, you know, it's announced with a lot of fanfare, and this was not. So you can take that to mean what you want.
A busy summer, a busy spring semester, and that gets us to kind of to last month when 5 student groups were temporarily suspended by UWM. And this had to do with an Instagram post or Instagram story. What can you tell us about the suspensions and the students involved here?
The student groups, they told me that this suspension means that they can no longer reserve rooms on campus, and some of them received student fee money, some money that helps offset their costs. Temporary suspension sort of cuts off those resources, but they've told me that won't really stop them. It's pretty minimal punishment. They're even potentially considering suing over this suspension. They haven't filed yet, as far as I know. I mean, if UWM's intent was to sort of slow them down heading into the fall semester, it sort of seems to have had the opposite effect.
And that was, you know, a big question that I had, too, is that I had reached out to UWM to better understand what was going on here. It was interesting because they told me they didn't have anyone that could talk about the situation. This was just after they released a press release about the situation. So, again, kind of leaving a lot of media in the lurch about what is happening between the groups and the university. Where do you think stand now?
You know, I've asked them, are you planning to set up another encampment for the fall semester? And they haven't said yes for sure, but they've said we definitely haven't ruled it out. And we definitely plan to continue our efforts throughout the semester. What that looks like, whether it is an encampment or holding daily protests or rallies, stuff like that. I think we're still, we'll probably have a better indication this week and next week with the semester starting.
You know, I want to also take us back to kind of this parallel relationship that you had talked about between UW and UWM and the kind of role that UW and the UW system plays in all of this. So UW just passed a new protest policy that a free speech expert called clearly unconstitutional, which is pretty strong language. What do we know about the policy changes there?
Yeah, I'm still digging into it. It was just announced last week, right before the semester started, which I thought was interesting timing. There's various, you know, changes. I think the one that really stood out to me was that no, quote, expressive activity is allowed within 25 feet of a university building, and that distance can even expand if police determine that there's some sort of threat to safety. Which 25 feet, it's a pretty far distance. And as the student newspaper reported, that would mean they couldn't even, like, distribute their student papers next to a campus building. I've seen nationally a lot of reporting, a lot of universities that struggled with encampments in the spring have, like, passed much tighter policies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, like, free speech experts have said that they're, like, overreacting to mm-hmm. what happened last spring.
And this is also the flagship university of the UW system. How could that potentially affect schools like UWM?
Yeah, I mean, it's often the case, you know, Madison will take the lead in passing a policy or making revisions, doing some sort of project, being like the pilot, just because they have more resources to sort of test it out. And a lot of times the smaller campuses will adopt the same policy or similar policies or follow suit with that sort of project or something like that. So I would not be surprised if UWM also announces changes to their policies that are very similar to Madison's.
You know, a final question I had for you is that this whole story and all of these threads from a reporter's point of view, I would just imagine would just be so hectic. So many voices, like wheels always in motion, and a topic that's so charged. What's the challenge been in getting this right and reporting on this?
Yeah, this has been a very difficult story for me to cover, and I've certainly not covered it alone. Our religion reporter at the paper, Sophie Carson, she's done a fantastic job. She has a lot more of the background on what pro-Palestinian protesters have wanted, what the Jewish community, how they feel about it. There's a lot of different voices. I mean, you have the chancellors, you have UW System Administration, you have the student protesters, you have the Jewish community, which is divided itself. I mean, some were protesting with the pro-Palestinian protesters. Others felt very threatened by the encampment. So there's just a lot of different voices, different groups, and it's hard to try to capture all of them into stories. I mean, you know, when we're writing three stories a day as this develops, it can be tricky.
That was Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spoke with Like Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. WUWM is a service of UW-Milwaukee. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a duck that inspired Milwaukeeans during a time of divisiveness and how her legacy lives on today. But first, we'll share how WUWM has been covering elections this year and the ways we're working to make election information more useful and accessible to you. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin has one more election coming up this year on November 5th. We'll elect a new president, a U.S. senator, congressional representatives, and lots of state senators and representatives. With so many races coming up, WUWM has been working to make our election coverage more useful and accessible to you. This work is driven by an election survey that we opened to the public last fall, where we ask what questions you have about elections and voting. We've received more than 1,000 responses, and we've been using that data to drive our election coverage. That includes a number of special projects, and to tell you about them, I'm joined by editor and project leader Emily Files and digital manager Michelle Matternowski. Hello to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So as I mentioned, WUWM has some special election projects in the works. They include some things listeners might already be familiar with, like our voter guides and voter roundtables. But I want to start with you, Michelle. You're working on something that's very new and exciting, and it's actually a video series about elections with Gertie the Duck as our guide. Share more.
Of course. So WUWM hatched a plan. Get it?
Yep.
To use Gertie the Duck this election season to help Milwaukeeans better understand why elections are important and how they work. Kind of think Schoolhouse Rock. I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill.
Just a little bill.
Yeah. So and how effective that was in teaching adults, children, about civics. So Audrey, let's play a little bit of the first video to help set the stage for our animated Gertie's Guide to the Elections video series.
All right, I'm excited. Let's hear it.
Gertie was a famous Milwaukee duck. She and her ducklings were known around the world.
Whoa, was she famous?
Por qué?
The year was 1945. The United States was in World War II. Everyone was involved in the fight overseas.
As WUWM's Rob Larry was explaining in his old-timey voice, Gertie the Duck built a nest in downtown Milwaukee during World War II, and in doing so, captured the nation's hearts. Gertie helped people feel hope during a difficult time, and now Gertie, the Milwaukee legend, is back. Well, actually, we're using her great-great-great-great-grandniece. I think there's four greats in there. And she is here to teach her ducklings and all of you out here in the Milwaukee area about our voting process. So as the November 5th election approaches, WWM will be releasing short videos focused on why it's important to vote, how elections in Wisconsin work, and what to expect on Election Day. We've been working with a local illustrator and animator, Mark Peterson, to create these short videos, and you'll also hear some familiar voices in them, including Lake Effect Sam Woods. He's Pee-wee, and let's just say that Pee-wee's the immature duckling of the group.
I like the duckling that has a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Some
spoilers
here.
I like the emo
here.
Duckling. Is there an emo duckling with a little bang?
Yes, that's Freddie.
Okay. Yeah, so keep an eye out for the great, 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 great Gertie and her ducklings. And where can people watch these little explainers?
Did you say whittle?
Whittle. Little duck explainers.
We're going to be posting them on our website as well as on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook. So the first one is out now, and the new ones will be released every 2 weeks leading up to Election Day. And then, Audrey, you are talking to an author who wrote a children's book about Gertie. And what did she think about us using Gertie as our guide to elections?
Yeah, I did speak to author Sherry Swanson. She wrote the book about Gertie and her history, her story that kind of inspired you guys in the group to create this video series. And I told her about our plans to use Gertie to help people be more informed about the voting process. And here's what she had to say about our Gertie-inspired series.
You know, I'm thrilled with it because for me, I feel like it's a patriotic story. And I feel like voting is the most patriotic thing that we can do.
Yes, so Gertie is patriotic, and I hope she'll put some fun in our election coverage.
Yes, and the Gertie series is all about educating folks, as you mentioned. And Emily, you're leading a project that's also meant to answer people's questions about elections, our WUWM voter guide. Can you share a little more about that? We've had various iterations for races up till now, of course.
Yeah, it's always sort of dependent on what's happening in the election, what's going to be in the voter guide. But it's something that we've been working on for a few years and building on to make better and more responsive to what people want to know. And it's on our website. It includes information about election deadlines, registering to vote, what you can and can't do in the voting booth. But it really is mainly about who and what you'll be voting for. So we have lots of information about candidates on the ballot and questions on the ballot. So for this election, Wisconsin voters are electing new representatives to the state assembly and Senate. And it's actually the first election under new legislative maps that aren't heavily gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. So we have a map tool you can use to zoom in to where you live and find which assembly or Senate district you're in and who the candidates are. And we've heard from people through our election survey that it can be hard to find information on these more local down ballot races. So we're trying to fill that information gap with our voter guide.
As you've mentioned, the voter guide has been growing and expanding over the years. This year, we're producing a printed voter guide as well for the first time ever. What does that include?
Yeah, so we're making a printed voter guide for Milwaukee area voters. It'll have information on the constitutional amendment on the November ballot, the U.S. Senate candidates, some local assembly and Senate races, and general election information like voter registration deadlines and voting absentee. So it'll be a lot of useful election information in one printed booklet, and we'll be handing out the printed voter guides at libraries and other public places. So keep an eye out for those.
those.
Looking forward to those for sure. Michelle, there's another printed election project we've been working on, the Pocket Guide. What is that all about?
Yeah, well, we were brainstorming ways to present the information that we're gathering for this upcoming election, a way to share the information about candidates, like Emily talked about, and voting process, and Gertie's Guide to Elections, and we landed on the Pocket Guide. So think back to middle school. You're trying to remember your locker combination. You're passing some notes back and forth. And remember those little folded paper fortune tellers?
Yep.
Okay, so we made one of those. Some people call them cootie catchers, and it's full.
You're about to give me cooties?
Yeah. So we made one of them full of election information, and I thought a good way to kind of give a little preview of what's inside of it is for Audrey. Try this out. So we got colors here for you to pick.
Let's go gold.
Gold. Okay, so we're going to do G-O-L-D. Okay, and now inside you get a picture of a duck. Why is it important to vote? What's up with these questions on my ballot? And can I use my phone in the voting booth?
Let's go with, can I use my phone in the voting booth?
Okay, so then you open up that little flap, and it sends you it gives you a QR code to then send you to a web post that Emily actually wrote up that answers people's elections questions. So the survey we were referring to in the beginning of this, Emily looked through that to see, you know, what do you want to know about when it comes to elections, and she wrote up a post. And that was one of them, is can I use my phone in the voting booth? So, yeah, so it takes you to a page. And then if you would have picked, like, the duck, for say, that would take you to a QR code to get you to Gertie's Guide to Elections. We also have one to take you to our election survey and then one to our voter guide. So kind of similar to where the printed voter guide will be, we'll be also having these little pocket guides out. And it's just a way to
Make friends.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. A way to become friends with WWM and our election content.
Love it. One other thing we did this year was a podcast called Swing State of the Union. It dives into Wisconsin's political history and helps listeners understand why Wisconsin is a swing state.
Yes. So all 10 of those episodes are now available. We did this podcast leading up to Milwaukee hosting the Republican National Convention. So you can find these wherever you listen to podcasts. There's some really, I would say, good episodes that kind of give you insight into how money in politics work, polarization. There's one about how Emily was talking about the new maps that we're going to be having, kind of like the history behind our maps. It examines the last election in 2020. So it's a great listen to give you a deep dive into why Wisconsin matters so much in this upcoming presidential election.
Yeah, if the constant candidate visits didn't give you a clue, you can deep dive in a podcast. And finally, the last election project we want to talk about is something I've been closely involved in along with you, Emily. It's our voter roundtables. So do you want to start us off by explaining the concept of what these are?
Sure. So we've been reaching out to people who filled out our election survey to ask them to participate in voter roundtables. These are kind of like focus groups where we dig into what Wisconsin voters are thinking about the presidential candidates and the issues this election. And our first voter roundtable was back in the spring with a mix of voters with different political views. Then we had one leading up to the RNC with Republicans. And our most recent roundtable was with left-leaning voters to see how they feel about Kamala Harris taking over as the Democratic nominee from Joe Biden.
Yeah, so much has changed over the last few months as we've been putting these roundtables together. And it's been interesting to hear people's perspectives and how much of a timestamp they kind of are, you know, because if mm-hmm. we brought that first group back, it's totally different situation, you know, different candidates. So we've also had fun essentially bringing in random groupings of people and watch them interact and have a conversation with one another in a way that a lot of people probably aren't used to. So I'd like to thank everyone again who's participated. Mm-hmm. But it's been really interesting and nice just to have a good conversation.
Yeah. And a long conversation. We're trying to get beyond the sound bites. We know Wisconsin voters can't be captured in one or two sound bites. People are complex. And it's, you know, it's hard to say in a 2 or 4 minute story, you know, the full reality of what is driving people's decisions this election. So spending, you know, 30, 40 minutes just letting Wisconsin voters talk to each other. We're hoping it gives more insight during this very contentious election year.
And one thing we heard in our survey was that people want to hear from voters unlike themselves, so it really mm-hmm. helps to meet that need as well.
Yeah, and also Wisconsin is in such a national spotlight right now. There's, you know, the presidential candidates are visiting, it seems like, every other week, and the national media is doing lots of stories from here. So kind of thinking about our responsibility as a local newsroom, this is one of the things we're doing to try to, you know, dig into what voters here are thinking and kind of give them a platform.
Definitely. And we're hoping to have one more voter roundtable before the November 5th election. So stay tuned for that. Emily Files and Michelle Maternowski, thank you so much for joining me to talk about WUWM's election projects.
There's so many of them.
Of so course. Many.
Thanks, Audrey.
Looking forward to November 6th.
Emily Files is our editor and project manager, and Michelle Maternowski is our digital editor. You can find all of the projects and information we discussed at WUWM.com. Right outside of WUWM Studios in the Chase Tower is the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge. And sitting proudly on top of the bridge is a statue of Gertie the Duck. Gertie captured the attention and love of Milwaukeeans and people around the world in 1945 when she picked an unlikely nesting spot on a tall post sticking out of the Milwaukee River downtown. Gertie and the five ducklings that hatched were a welcome distraction and source of hope for the public who were downcast from the constant news and events of World War II. Their presence not only inspired statues, but also a children's book called Gertie, the Darling Duck of World War II. It's written by Sherry Swanson, who joins me now to share more about how Gertie impacted her. Sherry, welcome to Lake Effect.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to talk all things Gertie.
So first off, how did you find out about the story of Gertie, and what inspired you to turn it into a children's book?
I read about this story in a used bookstore in Cambria, California, and it was just a little newspaper clip. And I thought, that is just such a story of hope and community and people coming together in a dark time and place. And I loved it, and I filed it away. And when I went to get my master's in writing for children and young adults, I pulled that back out and thought, this should be a picture book. And then I started to do the research and all the digging that you have to do to flesh it out. And so I've loved this story for a long time, a long, long time.
I love that. Do you recall when that article was from? Was it like a primary article from the time?
Yes, it was a contemporary I believe a summary of the news articles that had been coming out in the Milwaukee Journal, and it had been in the Reader's Digest. And so the book that I found in that that used store was called, I think it was called 50 Animals You'll Never Forget, and one of them was Gertie, and it was just a little summary. I don't believe it was written by Gordon McQuarrie, who was the journalist who wrote some of the more catchy little bits on Gertie. I think it was a summary. And then when I at the time I could pull up the journal online to do the research. And the more you dig on a story like this, just the more you are amazed at how pivotal the story was, not just for Milwaukee, but for our country and for our soldiers. And, you know, it was inspiring around the world. I mentioned that in the back papers of the book. The story got picked up and went everywhere. And the people of Milwaukee were just, I think, heroes to me in this story. And that was one thing. I came to Milwaukee and met some people that had been little children when Gertie was on her nest. And it was just very, very inspiring for me.
So I'd love to dig into that context a little more. What was happening in the world? You know, the story starts in April of 1945. So what were people going through that made Gertie such a beacon?
So it was pretty dark, right? We were in the very tail end of World War II. So we were hearing some of the more horrible things that were happening in concentration camps. And we had kamikaze pilots and during the course of Gertie's tenure on the nest, there were a lot of allies marching across and recapturing fallen capitals and things like that. But the news was really dark and it impacted everyone. And then Gertie's story came along at a time after all of these years had gone by, and the United States didn't enter the war right away. So the war itself had been going on longer. It was a disheartening time. And so a story about a community rallying around this little duck was just something to sort of divert your attention and give you something to hope for. So Milwaukee had this huge challenge of keeping her safe, right? Because everyone's watching, and they just rose to that challenge in amazing, heroic ways. Not all of which made it into the book, but just extremely, that's what I was talking about when I met the people that had seen her as a girl. And I said, you know, I'm a little California girl, you know, not alive in 1945, but this story just makes me tear up with how Milwaukee rose to the challenge.
Well, and speaking of the ways we kind of rose to the challenge of protecting Gertie and her ducklings, one detail I particularly liked and learned about for the first time was how committed the bridge tenders were, for one, but also that they were deputized to arrest people if they interfered with Gertie.
Exactly. It was important. And some of the details that were on the editing room floor were people that had tried to do stupid things, you know, shoot coins at her, throw the cigarette butts at her. And so Boy Scouts were on guard. There was a humane officer on guard that had the ability to arrest, and the bridge tenders were so protective. They called Gertie's ducklings their godchildren, and they were going to make sure those ducklings made it.
This story, obviously, as you mentioned, has a ton of research going into it. So can you share some of the research or fun things you found that went into this book, or any details that stick with you that perhaps didn't make the final print?
Well, there are some harsh things, you know, that were happening in the war. And it's a book for children, so I didn't mention some of those things about, you know, the casualties that at the time her eggs started hatching, we had just announced a million American casualties, things like that. But the one of the things that I found fascinating in doing the research is it was like a novelty picture, you know, that someone took passing by the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge, and it was kind of buried in the newspaper. And then you see Gertie start moving up, right? You know, starting to get to be further up in the headlines. And pretty soon, a story about Gertie is sharing the front page with peace talk discussions and, you know, Hitler discussions, kamikaze pilot discussions. And it was like, it got elevated to that level of import. And I found that super, super fascinating. It's hard to understand in our instant news generation, right, how important these news flashes were with people sitting around their radios or maybe watching newsreels and things like this, eager to hear how the eggs are doing. And so many reporters devoted to following this, and photographers. And it was quite an amazing thing. Probably hard for us to fully get our heads around, not having grown up in the radio generation, right? And now, you know, instant news generation. So I think that sense of hope, the bells pealing out over the city of Milwaukee when the eggs are hatching, all of those kind of details were extremely moving to me.
Yeah, it's very moving, and it's quite the epic journey when you, you know, take a minute just to think about, oh, this was about a duck we all just like clinged on to, you know, from a Memorial Day parade to being in the Gimbel's window front to their release. Like, it's quite an odyssey. And for you, learning so much about this, right, and getting so attached, what kind of things helped you look at this as a children's book author and take away, like, this is the most important thing I want to, like, teach kids about Gertie?
That's actually, for me, the hardest thing, is to turn a massive amount of research into a picture book, right? Because a picture book is going to be less than 1,000 words. And I've been researching, you know, World War II and Milwaukee all of this history. And what you need to do is pull a thread out to make it into a picture book. So what fits that thread? And so for me, the heart of this story is the symbol of hope that Gertie gives to Milwaukee and to the world. And also mixed in with that and part of that is how Milwaukee rose to this challenge and became just heroes to the world during this period in time.
With this setting, not only in the world, but Milwaukee itself, right? The look of Milwaukee in 1945. How did you work with your illustrator to portray this different moment in time?
Right. Renee Grafe is amazing. I can't even express how fortunate I feel that she was picked to illustrate this book. She has a history of illustrating historical stories, Little House on the Prairie, American Girl, and she is a Milwaukee native. So we both pulled up old photographs. We pulled up, she worked with the Historical Society to get exactly right. She and I both are very detail-oriented of making sure we're saying that, you know, saying it right. There were a lot of pictures in the journal as you're reading the stories about Gertie. Some of them we put in the back, and some of them are suggested in the artwork. So we're lucky this is a very photographed duck in there. And the Historical Society has preserved a lot of that. I couldn't have imagined it better than this. So yeah, it all worked out well.
Gertie is, you know, a timeless story, especially for us Milwaukeeans. And having this story stay with you for so long, and then through the process of the book, how does Gertie continue to lift your spirits? What does she represent for you?
I think Gertie and the whole Gertie story is, for me, a microcosm of the power of community. And not just Gertie, but that coming together, the home front coming together in World War II, and that Gertie became sort of a symbol of all of that, right? Because everyone worked together to help her. And I feel like it's a hopeful story. To me, it's a story that in a bleak, horrible time, there will be a glimmer of hope. And it might be in the most unlikely of things, like a duck that chose this very preposterous place to put her nest that was unsafe and risky, but became a symbol of American spirit and of particularly of a community working together. So for me, I read this story, it's nearly 100 years old, and it's still uplifting because it shows what people can do when they're on a common purpose.
So we're going to be using Gertie's image as a friendly feathered face to kind of walk people through voting information and much more. What do you think of us borrowing Gertie for this kind of mission that's a little different from her original purpose in 1945?
You know, I'm thrilled with it because for me, I feel like it's a patriotic story. And I feel like voting is the most patriotic thing that we can do. So I find it just a delightful thing. And I have to say, I'm like an old Schoolhouse Rock fangirl. So the idea of this becoming in that sort of vibe is just delightful. But I think it's a patriotic story. It's not a divisive story. It's, you know, that sometimes politics can be. It's a story that you're, you know, the Americans coming together and working toward a common goal, which is what voting is.
Well, Sherry, I want to thank you so much, one, for all the time and love and attention you put towards Gertie and the book that it produced, but for sharing more of the story with me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Audrey.
Sherry Swanson is the author of Gertie, the Darling Duck of World War II. We'll take one more break, and then we'll learn about Milwaukee music legend Al Jarreau and how the city honors his memory with a local park. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Al Jarreau was a legendary jazz, pop, and R&B artist born and raised here in Milwaukee. No matter where he went or who he was talking to, he always spoke fondly of Milwaukee and his upbringing here. Last summer, Milwaukee showed love back to Jarreau by naming a park in his honor. Lake Effect Sam Woods visited the park and talked to organizer Barbara Smith of Imani United about how she and her partners got the name changed and what it means to memorialize Jarreau in her neighborhood.
What does it really mean to be free? I think about this question a lot. Is it not having to work a job you don't like? Is it spending your time traveling the world? Perhaps it's about amassing wealth or pledging allegiance to the flag. Maybe it has to do with leading with your heart and letting your mind get out of the way. But for Al Jarreau, freedom sounded something like this. Born and raised in Milwaukee, Jarreau was a legendary jazz, pop, and R&B artist, active from the 1960s until he passed away in 2017. Throughout his career, he collected Grammys across jazz, pop, and R&B genres. He toured the world, he produced theme songs for TV, and he inspired generations to be themselves and to dream big. But beyond the accolades, Jarreau always traced his inspiration to growing up in Milwaukee. No matter where he went in the world, what awards he won, whoever he was talking to, he always spoke fondly of Milwaukee and memorialized this love in a song about feeling at home here. 2,000 miles from the arms that bore me, 2,000 miles from my sweet home, Milwaukee. But I keep singing, roll on, Milwaukee road, rolled in the rain and cold. Don't you know this train born in my mama's dream to be happy? And now, Milwaukee is memorializing our love for Jarreau. A cozy pocket park near the intersection of Locust and 30th Street was renamed Alwin Lopez Jarreau Park, or Al Jarreau Park for short. This effort to rename the park was led by Imani United, a resident group dedicated to serving the Imani neighborhood, which is located in the heart of Milwaukee's north side, a couple miles from where Jarreau grew up. Most often, their work involves talking to residents about changes they'd like to see in the neighborhood related to housing, economic development, and education. But they cover a lot of ground and really are a fixture in the neighborhood. Barbara Smith, an Imani resident herself and chair of Imani United's Housing and Economic Development Committee, has been working on getting the park renamed after Al Jarreau for a few years. This took time because resident voice is important to Barbara, as she's seen plenty of times where people from outside Imani come in with these grand ideas on what to do to improve the neighborhood, but just don't consult the people who already live there. I talked to Barbara about how Imani United engage with residents and community partners to not only get the park's name changed, but also generate ideas on what they'd like to see in the park and what they'd like it to look like and feel like.
Residents were engaged in giving their ideas and giving their feedback on what they would like to see happen in the park. Because it's one thing to rename a park, but to revamp the park, to make it welcoming, inviting, so that people will come to the park, utilize the park, is important as well. So out of those feedback sessions from those residents, a lot of the ideas came about. So again, the momentum began to build. So then we start looking at, okay, so what could actually take place in the park? What could the park actually look like? You know, we talked about it. I think we went back and forth maybe four or five different times before we actually kind of settled on something we think that the Imani neighborhood is going to be proud to say, this is our park. This is our park at park. This is our tribute to Al Jarreau, even on a smaller scale, because Al Jarreau he's just this fantastic person. So this is just our small tribute to a great being.
You might have caught that I've said the park was renamed Al Jarreau Park. That's because the park was named the Cocker Play Area after a guy named Emmanuel Cocker, who owned and subdivided land in the area over 100 years ago. And interesting fact, he actually founded a town in Kansas as well. The town was named Cocker City after he won naming rights in a poker match. Yes, really, a poker match. But walk around Imani today and ask people what they know about Emmanuel Cocker, and you're likely to get a lot of confused looks. But Al Jarreau, his relevance to Milwaukee lives on. In addition to always speaking highly of Milwaukee wherever he went, Jarreau stayed involved in the city as long as he lived. In a 2016 op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Jarreau outlined the need for arts and music education funding, as schools in the region were cutting arts programming to meet their budgets. He saw the limitless potential in Milwaukee's young people, and he saw arts funding as imperative for unlocking that potential and getting them engaged positively with the world and themselves. In the op-ed, he says, quote, "A young person who has a trumpet or ballet slippers or some paintbrushes in their bag is probably not also carrying a weapon." Jarreau's concern for youth development is echoed by Barbara, who hopes that renaming the park in Jarreau's honor inspires people, especially young people, to learn about Jarreau and let his understanding of freedom take hold within them.
It's extremely important because it allows residents, especially our youth, especially our babies, to see that someone who had such a great relevance years ago is still important, is still relevant to this day. And it's also a teaching moment for those young people. Again, going back to engaging residents and allowing them and us to be a part of the greatness that's going to take place in this park is so very important. And again, it just opens the eyes, opens the mind to something that very well could not have been thought of prior to what they're going to actually be able to see.
Beyond just renaming the park, residents also wanted art, which, you know, is fitting for a park named after an artist. So Imani United and partners brought in Milwaukee-based muralist Tia Richardson to lead a mural painting with the help of residents. The mural, like Al Jarreau's music, is vibrant, colorful, and free-flowing, featuring landmarks from the Imani neighborhood, children playing, and of course, Jarreau himself. Barbara hopes this mural and the park become a place of peace, where you can step away from the cacophony of the world and remember what freedom meant to Al Jarreau and what it means to you.
The conversations that were held just amongst strangers, because it may have been our first time seeing each other. Initially, we were talking about the mural, but then it went into other conversations. Little children, I remember two little young ladies, extremely helpful. They wanted to help Miss Tia put the paints out, put out the paint brushes, lay the cloths down. And of course, they were painting. And then even with the cleanup, to the very end, they helped, clean up everything, carry things to the Miss Tia's vehicle and to the storage bin. Just to see their excitement and what was happening, what was going on, was wonderful and great. So if nobody else, we know that those two little people, they're going to make sure that no damage comes to this mural, because I think they've taken personal ownership, which is great. And then just looking at the mural, there is quite a few different items or landmarks within the Imani neighborhood that are a part of this mural. There are some planters that are on the mural. Those planters are located right in the Imani neighborhood on the Dominican Center grounds. And then the vibrant colors just brings a whole lot of energy, brings a whole lot of life to the neighborhood. So if there's ever a blah moment or somebody is feeling some type of way, come to the park, look at the vibrancy of the mural, and bring your phone and put on some Al Jarreau music. and I'm sure whatever that little funk is, you are going to be okay. And that's the point. That's the purpose, to bring more positive energy, you know, not only to the park, but to yourself if, you know, you're going through something or you're feeling some type of way.
Sure. I asked Barbara what song comes to mind when she thinks of Al Jarreau, and she said his song Morning was her favorite. That it feels like a lullaby that encourages her to step back and dream. For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
That was Barbara Smith, Amani resident and chair of the Amani United Housing and Economic Development Committee. She spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. Aljaro Park is located near the intersection of 30th and Locust Street. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from WUWM editor and project manager Emily Files and WUWM digital manager Michelle Maternowski this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with the CEO of Milwaukee Film about the status of their programs and to get a look at their financial outlook. Plus, we'll kick off Climate Solutions Week, where we'll explore how climate change is affecting food. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.